Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it's June 7th, 2016. Enormous changes are afoot in virtually every dimension of life. On the plus side, technology continues to improve and amaze with its vast potential. And on the downside, a massive wealth inequality has been fueled by a transfer process from everyone, it seems, to an increasingly tiny and powerful elite. Forget the 1%. We're talking about the 0.01%. And this did not happen overnight. And many factors had to converge to make this happen. Some were structural, endemic to the system of money we've got, and some were intentional, driven by self-interested regulatory and legal changes. But make no mistake, to paraphrase journalist and author Rana Faruhar, American capitalism faces a great crisis. Her research leads to the conclusion, which will be familiar to my listeners, it's that Wall Street is choking the economy. In fact, the crisis is so profound that it can be described as a crisis of faith. Our very economic system that has lifted and supported so many people for so long is breaking down, and with it, our sense of social cohesion and perceptions of justice and fairness. So I'm very pleased to introduce Rana Faruhar as our guest today. Rana is the assistant managing editor at Time and the magazine's economics columnist. She also appears regularly on CNN as global economic analyst and is the author of the recently released book, Makers and Takers, released on May 17, 2016. Rana, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first, congratulations on your book and the fact that it's doing really very well.
Yeah, thank you so much. I feel like the message is getting out there, and I think it's good timing. The political cycle in many ways sort of confirms the underlying thesis of the book, so I'm pleased that to have a platform.
Well, let's begin with that. The book's title even, Makers and Takers. I love it. But for my listeners, how did that title get selected?
So, you know, you might remember back in the last presidential election cycle in 2012 that Paul Ryan, who is now, of course, the Speaker of the House, used this term to talk about the amount of people in the country that were not paying income tax. And, you know, these were apparently the takers, and the makers were the capitalists that were creating jobs. Well, you know, as somebody that's been studying the economy and covering business in the economy for 23 years, I sort of went, Actually, that trickle-down message hasn't been working for some time, that, you know, the financial system has actually changed in such a way that it's actually trickling up wealth. And that's one of the reasons that we have the stagnant wages and the longest, weakest recovery of the post-war era, which we're in right now. And so I wanted to kind of rebrand those terms and say, let's really question who's making and who's taking here and what's really happening at a Main Street level in our economy.
Well, it, very timely, of course, and I would only maybe suggest that from my perspective, it's not trickling up, it's a torrent at this point.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. I mean, if you look at the last 40 years of the share of the pie, the economic pie that's being taken by certainly by the top 1%, and as you point out, the top 0.01%, but also the labor share of the pie has gone to record low levels. So there's this fundamental dichotomy in the economy now where if you are well off, you are doing better than you ever have before in history. But the majority of Americans, the majority of workers in this country haven't gotten a raise in real terms since the early 1990s, and many people in the working class and minorities haven't gotten one since the late 1960s. So that's a real problem in an economy that is 70% consumer spending, because at some point the math starts to not work. If people don't have more money, they can't spend, and we get these underlying growth problems. My book is trying to look at one of the reasons behind that, and I'm arguing that it's that the financial markets themselves are no longer supporting business growth.
Now, let's talk about that. You know, it was, I'm guessing it was probably 2007. I went and I heard author Kevin Phillips, and he was very worried about financialization of the U.S. economy back then.
Yeah.
And so I looked at my notes, and he had a quote from back then. He said, "Today's financial services sector, by contrast, is a grasping, gargantuan combination of banks, stockbrokers, insurance men, loan sharks, credit card issuers, hedge fund speculators, securitization mavens, and mortgage operators. I think you left a few people off that list. It seems to have only gotten maybe gone further and faster since then. Would you agree?
I would. And I think that what's happened is that our economy has become financialized. So by that, what I'm talking about is that the size of the financial sector, which includes not only banks, but hedge funds, private equity funds, real estate trusts, the mortgage market, you know, all of the parts of the economy that basically move money around, that part of the economy has more than doubled since the 1980s. And so you've got a financial sector now that creates only 4% of jobs in this country, but takes 25% of all corporate profits. So that's a lot of economic oxygen that's being taken out of the room. Now, what are the consequences for this? Well, one of the consequences is slower growth. Why is growth slowing? Well, in part because the whole model of banking has changed. The killer stat in my book is that there's a lot of deep academic research to show that only 15% of all the money sloshing around American financial institutions ends up invested in Main Street business. So where's the rest of it going? Well, it's being used to trade against existing assets, stocks, bonds, houses. It's doing something entirely different than what the banking system was set up to do, which is take all of our savings, funnel it through financial institutions into business investments. Those businesses then grow and create jobs. Well, when you've only got 15% of the money in the markets doing that, you've got a problem.
Well, it as Matt Taibbi put it, there's a giant vampire squid.
Well, they're sucking sound in the squid. That's right. The squid is it's such a great visual metaphor for this.
Well, but it's very important. We have a lot of people at my site and elsewhere. They talk about all the isms, capitalism versus free markets, this and that. You hit on a very important point here, which is that capitalism really should exist in support of the real economy. So what's the real economy? Well, people create goods and perform services, and then the money is just supposed to be a medium of exchange that facilitates that. And what you're describing, with just 15% of all the newly created money or money outstanding out there actually creating new goods and services, you're describing an enormous imbalance between the claims on the real economy and the real economy itself.
That's right. I mean, you know, the financial system, the whole point of it is supposed to be that banks will allocate capital to places where it's most productive. That is entirely broken. If you look at the way money is being funneled around this closed loop of the financial system itself, enriching more or less, and I'm being generous here, the top 10% of the country, which owns 80% of the asset base, stocks, bonds, houses. That's a bubble that is enriching just the wealthy while not actually creating real underlying growth. And, you know, one of the things I must say that has been fascinating as I have put this book out there, I've gotten calls surprisingly from a lot of financiers who were very interested in the thesis because they recognize that at some point that starts to undermine their portfolios because, you know, sooner or later, everything that happens on Wall Street connects back to Main Street. And I think we're at that tipping point now where I think you're going to start to see market correction. I mean, we've had markets at record highs while Main Street has been stagnating. And I think that we're at a turning point and these markets are eventually going to break.
I agree with that thesis because, of course, there has to be some relationship between the claims on the economy and the economy. Now, the Federal Reserve, starting under Greenspan, I've been tracking this a long time, decided that maybe the business cycle could be defeated and that it was never a good time to have a cleansing crisis. Yeah. Where do you think all this started? Where would you begin to place this?
Well, this is one of the most fascinating things that I found in my research. So I went back. I actually looked at a 100-year period of the financial markets in the U.S. because I wanted to see, in part, the similarities between the run-up to the financial crash of 1929 and the Great Depression and the subprime crisis. And there are some interesting similarities. But so the difference is after the Great Depression, we had some very sensible banking regulation that kept the system relatively, in good shape, working to support business until about the late 1960s, early 70s. And then what happened at that point was that the underlying GDP growth in America started to slow. Now, there were good reasons for this. In part, we had more international competition. Europe was starting to get back on its feet following the World War II, and the emerging markets were starting to emerge. And so some of that was just natural, the rise of the rest, the rise of foreign competition. But rather than then take real policy decisions that would actually change and enhance the growth picture in America, politicians in Washington decided, well, you know, that those are hard to do. It's kind of the guns and butter debate because, you know, when you're dividing up a shrinking pie, you have to make choices between economic stakeholders and somebody ends up being the loser in that and then you lose votes. So politicians didn't want to make those decisions. So they decided to pass the ball to the markets and say, the markets should figure out how to create growth. Let's deregulate interest rates. Let's let the Fed have more leeway to do easy monetary policy. And so basically from the 1970s onward, you start to see the growth of finance, and that really speeds up in the 1980s. And, you know, I want to be fair and say the decisions that were being taken, the policy decisions that allowed that growth of finance, they weren't venal. I mean, you know, people weren't trying to do bad things. You know, in some cases, there were some good arguments or reasons for various policy decisions, but they came with all these unintended consequences of funneling capital to less and less useful places, to high frequency trading, to complex securitization, to areas of the economy that just weren't doing all that much for Main Street. And we are now 40 years on living with the consequences of that. And, you know, you started by mentioning the Fed. The fact that we have to have near zero interest rates in this country, or zero in real terms, to create any growth at all is a mark of just how far we've come from thinking about what's good for Main Street.
Well, absolutely. And I agree maybe it wasn't venal, but I'm wondering if maybe disingenuous. So here, both Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen, they have professed surprise at the wealth gap, just like puzzling over it as if it were a new species of fungi that, that just sprouted from the grout in their kitchen tiles. We're like, what is this thing? But from my view, the relentless decline in interest rates you just mentioned, plus the failure to allow or permit that proper cleansing of the system, seems to have been an all but certain guarantee for us to end up where we have. Yeah. Would you agree with that?
I would. I mean, it's interesting. One of the fascinating things, and it's just the most bizarre thing, is that most economic models, including the models used by the Federal Reserve for many decades, don't actually include the financial system as a kind of a data input. I mean, if you can believe it, right. When we're modeling the economy, we actually don't think about how the financial system works. Now, that's changing. There's a whole school of economics now, post-2008, that's like, oh, yeah, that fungi did, not only did it sprout, it's taking over the entire bathroom. You know, we better figure out where it came from and start modeling that. So the pendulum is starting to shift, but in truth, you've got a point. I mean, people didn't model this stuff. They just didn't even think about the financial markets as being possibly an impactful point that they should be thinking about for how the economy works, which is just, it's incredible given how financialized we've become.
Well, it's been known for a very long time that those who are closest to the monetary spigot do best. That was there's a French term for it that comes from the 1700s. So to me, it was mysterious that the Fed had somehow lost its footing to the extent that they were unaware what kind of wealth gap they would be creating by printing literally trillions of new dollars into the system.
Well, I think that this is all part of a larger phenomenon. It's almost an existential shift. There's actually a wonderful academic, Jerry Davis, that studies at the University of Michigan, that studies financialization. And he talks about the Copernican shift towards the markets in our society. And I think what happened from the 1980s onwards, not only at policy levels, but at the personal level, with the rise of the 401k, the privatization of retirement, the fact that we're all in the stock market, we're all looking at Money Magazine and wondering about our portfolios, we all started to think that the markets do know best. And more than that, that finance and the financial markets are sort of the tippy top of the economic pyramid that we should all aspire to. You know, after we move from being an agrarian society to a manufacturing powerhouse to a services economy, that finance is the very top. And when you think about that model, then you do what's best for finance. But I'm arguing that we need to have this other Copernican shift. We need to turn that triangle on its head and say financial services, and I stress the word service, should be in service to business rather than the other way around.
Well, that's a fantastic idea. And as well, we've talked about some of the class warfare, if I can use that word, that, that seems to have arisen. But I want to talk about the generational effects of this as well. So I understand there was a subprime housing crisis. Housing prices were falling for the first time since the Great Depression. It scared people. And the Federal Reserve under Ben Bernanke at the time said, we need to rescue this. So we're going to jam interest rates down. That will help support the real estate market. Fast forward. And we find that young people can't afford to get into this market anymore. Would it be inappropriate for young people to look at this and say, wow, the boomers have just saved themselves again at my expense?
Absolutely. And you're pointing to what I think will be the biggest political tension point of the next 20, 30, 50 years, which is this square off between the boomers and the millennials for a shrinking economic pie. And the pie is shrinking because we've had a completely perverse system that has enriched the few, the financial markets, at the expense of the many. And it's interesting you mentioned housing, because housing policy is a big part of this. And in fact, we often in this country, when we talk about the dysfunctional nature of the financial markets, we often have a very siloed conversation about too big to fail banks, and we need to break up the banks and that'll fix everything. It may be a good idea to break up some of the biggest banks, but that's not a silver bullet for fixing this problem that we're talking about, because it's a much deeper and broader problem. It intersects with the way housing policy is run, with the way tax policy supports debt, with the way our retirement system works. You know, there are all these kind of concentric circles moving outward, and we actually have to step back and start looking at the entire ecosystem and how it incentivizes really bad behavior at every level.
Now, this is fascinating, particularly here we are recording this in the thick of the presidential primary cycle, soon to be a presidential election. From my view, many of the current U.S. Presidential candidates have a variety of prescriptions for how they might address the wealth gap or maybe the too big to fail phenomenon. But to me, they seem to be nibbling at the edges. And you're describing something that sounds much more structural and fundamental.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with you. I think that each candidate is trying to tackle some element of this, at least rhetorically. You've got Bernie talking about breaking up the big banks. You've got Hillary talking about the shadow banking system and strengthening the existing Dodd-Frank financial regulation. And, you know, you've got Donald Trump, who knows what he thinks from day to day, but you've got him sometimes talking about taxing hedge funders more, you know, talking about the people that make money from money, hedge funders, private equity. But each of those things is really just a tiny sliver of this larger problem whereby the financial markets no longer serve real business. The financial markets exist to essentially bid up the value of assets, creating asset bubbles, creating, for example, the sort of housing bubble you mentioned that prevents younger people from getting in on the housing market. And in order to fix the problem, we're going to have to tackle the whole system. And this is not going to be a silver bullet fix. You know, it's taken us 40 years to get here, 40 years of small policy changes in many, many different areas of our society and economy. And it's going to take a while to work backward from there.
So let's talk about how we might begin to address this. I'm interested in what sorts of things, you know, could and should maybe we ask for if we wanted to reverse this process. And by that, I mean, short of waiting for the next big, gigantic financial accident.
Right. No, and which, by the way, are coming more and more frequently. And that's part of financialization, that as an economy has a larger financial system, it also has more frequent financial crises. Mm. And financial crises, with the exception of wars and natural disasters, are the biggest destroyers of wealth. So you're absolutely right that this is a pressing issue. So there is some low-hanging fruit. I have a chapter in my book about solutions, and some of them are small and some of them are big. And one of the really bits of low-hanging fruit, I would say, is our tax code. So the U.S. tax code really subsidizes debt and encourages people to take on debt and write that off of their taxes. And that's both at the individual level and at the corporate level. So, you know, things like the mortgage interest tax deduction, you know, where I can come and buy more house, frankly, than I might need and then write it off my taxes. That's one example. The way in which corporations can issue more and more debt and write that off their taxes, that's another issue. We should be encouraging investment. We should be encouraging savings and just shifting that whole paradigm. So that's one really easy solution. There's also a lot that we could still do in terms of making the financial system as a whole more transparent. So post 2008, with the Dodd-Frank regulation. There were efforts to bring a lot of things out into the light, to make all those complex securities, those CDOs and CDSs, that what Warren Buffett calls weapons of mass financial destruction, to make them easier to track, so we would know who's holding risk and where it might explode. But that was only half successful, because the financial lobby really lobbied hard against a lot of this. They created loopholes. We need to close those loopholes. Whoever the next president is needs to really look very carefully at the existing holes in that regulation and plug them, because otherwise risk is kind of like water. It can just, wherever it finds a crack, it can travel and migrate.
Now, this process, though, is I agree with the prescriptions you've got in there. It feels to me like we have to go, it's in our culture at this point, right? Mm-hmm. So I go back 50 years and look at the popular cultural heroes. We had people back there. We had astronauts, scientists, mm-hmm. Explorers, mm-hmm. artists. There were literally no financial icons to speak of at that time.
True.
But now some of the wealthiest, most influential people out there, the people who get invited to Davos to talk about things, they're quite often people who literally make nothing but money, right? They're hedge
That's
fund
right.
operators, financial speculators. They're making trades for gains. It's brilliant. It's sophisticated. But it seems to me that financialization has included a cultural shift in attitudes.
Oh, for sure. I mean, absolutely. You just look at the sort of movies of our day. I mean, the HBO series Billions, or maybe it's a Showtime series, you know, we definitely glorify the financier to the exclusion of others. And that is a real problem. And this goes deep, because this gets into our educational system. I mean, I have a chapter on the problems with our MBA education, that it's so financially oriented, and kids come out and finance is still the number one area that they want to go into. They don't want to go into industry. And increasingly, you've got even the smartest scientific minds, the mathematicians. You know, you look at a quarter of the class of MIT graduates will end up on Wall Street figuring out sort of complex 14-dimensional algorithmic models for trading, instead of inventing the next, I don't know, green airplane engine over at Boeing, you know. And that is a real issue. So we have to look at education. We have to look at the way we even speak to each other. We use words from the financial lexicon. We talk about human capital. You know, we think of workers as being as expendable as assets themselves. And this is all part of this problem. You're absolutely right.
Well, it's so severe. I was just reading the other day about, I think Senator Grassley even called a nonprofit hospital to the carpet because they were suing the people who came in and couldn't pay. And so here you have a nonprofit hospital. It's about health, and they're filing literally thousands of suits per year to just pull what they can from people. And I think that probably feels okay. And the CEO of the hospital in question is earning $1.7 million for a reasonably small-sized Midwestern hospital. And so we do. We have a very large, increasing class of people who feel like they're worth it, and whatever the ends justify the means. The ends are, we need to earn as much as we can.
Right. And actually, you're bringing up another point that I cover in the book. Business itself has begun to act like banking. So there's some really wonderful academic work, again, that's been done looking at the percentage of revenue across all industry that comes from financial services and from just moving money around, hedging, trading, tax optimization, all these different things. And it's five times as much as it was in the 1980s. So it's as if we're all bankers now.
Well, absolutely. You know, I think it was about 10 years ago, I realized that GM was a financial company with a car company bolted to the side.
Right, right. No, absolutely. And you're seeing, you know, subprime auto loans being a problem in the last few years. I have a whole chapter actually in the book on GE, which is, their evolution is really fascinating. So GE is arguably the kind of original American innovator, corporate innovator, you know, founded by Thomas Alva Edison, created the light bulb, created any number of other fabulous inventions. But in the 1980s, under Jack Welch, and then continuing through the 1990s, they became a too big to fail financial institution. And actually, Jeff Immelt, who's now the CEO after the financial crisis, had to go hat in hand to Warren Buffett to ask for a loan to keep the company afloat. And I think that that was a real turning point for him. That was a real eye opener. And I've done some interviews with he and other executives there. And they've actually said, look, we came to a crisis point where we had to decide, are we going to be a bank with, you know, a few products attached, or do we want to really go back to our roots and be an innovator? And they decided to do the latter, and they've moved away from finance. They've been selling off their financial assets, and they're trying to now move into making things particularly geared for the emerging markets that are going through the kind of consumer boom, the development boom that the U.S. went through in the 1950s. So a lot of people are really watching that company to see, hey, can a big American company that went this far into the process of financialization pull back and really move to a different paradigm? I think it'll be very illustrative to see what happens.
Well, of course, to move from the taker back to the maker column. So let's go back to those numbers. You said, if I heard you right, that the financial sector has roughly doubled since 1980, and it's 25% of all corporate profits and that's maybe great. 4% of all jobs. So when I saw 2008 happen, and of course, Hank Paulson was reading the Marshall Law Act to people, and there was a lot of panic in the air. That was really, I thought, that self-introspection, look in the mirror, what have we been doing? Here's the number that I want to tack to yours. Mm. Since 1980, the United States has been expanding its debt at twice the rate of its nominal GDP growth.
Yeah.
Right. So you as an individual, Rana, you, and I as an individual know that I can't double my debt at twice the rate of my income growth. I have a math problem sooner or later. Shouldn't that have been the moment we said, wow, we have a math problem?
Absolutely. And it, you know, this is also a fascinating thing. A lot of the research around how much debt leads to financial crisis has been done post 2008. You know, people just weren't thinking about this stuff. They thought debt, great. You know, we're even subsidizing it with the tax code. But actually, yes, fast run-ups in debt in particular, it's almost the speed of the run-up in debt is almost more important than the sheer amount of debt. When you've got really, really fast run-ups in debt, you almost always get financial crises and economic downturns. And, you know, debt has been, I think, used as a palliative in our society. We've had slowing growth. We haven't taken the real hard decisions about, let's come up with a national growth strategy. Let's think about how to connect the dots between educators and job creators and fix infrastructure and do the really hard stuff that you have to do to create Main Street growth. Instead, we've just piled on more debt. We've used low interest rates as a tool, as part and parcel of that. Consumer debt also has expanded dramatically since the 1980s as a way of kind of distracting people from the fact that they haven't gotten a raise. And we have a huge debt bubble now. I mean, globally, there is now $57 trillion more debt out there in the world than there was before the financial crisis. So it's not like the problem's gotten any better.
Well, no, certainly. And so let's broaden out a little bit. Let's go global for just a second. You said the speed of the run-up in debt. As impressed as I was with the United States, China takes my breath away. Talk to us about that speed of run-up of debt.
Well,
in China.
China is, I think, the next theater, if you will, for financialization. So if you look at the amount of debt in China that's out there, it's incredible. It's about 300% of GDP. That's over three times what it is in the U.S. And more importantly, the pace of that debt run-up has been eye-popping. So if you go back to 2008, it took about a dollar of debt to create every dollar of growth in China. Today, it takes $4 of debt to create every dollar of growth. So they have a major, major debt bubble. And interestingly, they are also, even though they have a totally different political system than we do, they're at a kind of a similar pivot point politically that the U.S. was in the 1970s when growth began to slow. So growth has begun slowing in China, which again is natural. They've been growing at double digits for over a decade, and so that slowed to single digits and now low single digits. And so they have to change their model, and they have to go to a different kind of growth. They have to move from being a poor country to a middle-income country. Well, that requires hard political changes. It probably requires some real political reform and opening up of the system, but those are hard things to do, and they shake up vested interests. And so there's a big question about whether the Chinese are going to try and just do what the U.S. did, which is throw the ball to the markets. And in fact, one of the reasons you saw so much volatility last summer in the Chinese markets was for that very reason, because they were trying to liberalize markets and make people feel wealthier by growing asset bubbles, and then things collapsed, and we had a lot of global stock market volatility last August and September.
Well, I think the Chinese People's Bank could be forgiven for seeing that being a serial bubble blower is perhaps a workable strategy.
Well, that's true too. I mean, you know, it's funny. My book is actually being published in China, and I'm very pleased about that. I think it's a topic that they're extremely interested in, and they want to really understand how can we do it differently? Can we do it differently?
Now, it is fascinating. I have a number of connections with people from China, and I'm finding them to be thinking much more long-term, very broadly. I spend a lot of time in the energy space. I'm wondering in your research if you ran across this. So here's a central thesis of mine. It's that endless growth is not possible on a finite planet. Not an original idea, but it's lurking there as sort of the 800-pound gorilla that nobody talks about. And we have a financial system that seems to exist in two states, growing or collapsing. Yeah. And so I'm wondering if you ran across anybody who was sort of looking at this, I don't know, 10, 20, 50 years out and saying, Houston, we have a problem.
That is the $64,000 question. It's funny because right after the financial crisis, one of my key sources was a guy named Steve Roach, who happened to be the chief economist for Morgan Stanley Bank, and then he ran Morgan Stanley Asia. Brilliant guy. And I called him up and I said, "What just happened?" And he said, "Well, the financial markets have become unmoored from the real economy." And then we started talking about growth, and I said, "Well, what's going to happen now? I mean, you know, we've been used to huge trend growth, and can this really continue?" And he said, "Well, that's the big question. How much growth is viable?" And what's interesting is very few people, economists in particular, are brave enough to ask that question. And it is the obvious thing. It is the elephant lurking in the room. And I think that what we're starting to see is that we certainly need a different kind of growth. And it's interesting, you're in the energy space, so you probably know about many economists, people like Joe Stiglitz, are big fans of green growth projects that would basically employ more people in, say, the green energy space, really focus on innovation and job creation, but not on sort of the sheer growth rate itself. Let's not think about we need to hit 3%, 4%. Let's think about, can we employ people productively? Can we use resources more sustainably? And let's just change the whole way we think about growth.
Yes, and this is a fascinating topic. We will be employing more people in the energy space, and for a really geeky physical reason, which is that the energy return on energy invested from alternative energies is not the same as we got when we stuck the straws under the sand and got this really tasty oil out of the ground.
Right.
And so think of it from financial terms. If the return on investment is lower, you have to perform more work to get the same return, which means we need more people employed there. That's perhaps the good news. But for an economy that's unwilling to share the pie and say, we now have to make hard trade-offs, we're going to have less of this and more of that.
Yeah.
That's where I don't see the conversation beginning yet. And we've papered over that by pretending it doesn't exist, by printing lots and lots of money, which makes people feel good. As you said, it's a palliative. I'm growing increasingly concerned that we are adrift ourselves from a strategic standpoint. I did a lot of strategy work in big companies. There's a bunch of complex models out there, but it boils down to, where are we going? What are resources?
Yeah.
You know, that's it.
No, it's totally true. And I mean, you're pointing out that often the simplest questions are the best ones. You know, I mean, economists, by and large, live in an ivory tower. They speak in a lot of jargon. And this is something I encountered in my book again and again, where you would ask really simple questions like, is the financial institution actually providing clear, measurable benefit for the real economy? You know, oh gosh, we haven't studied that. You know, we've studied everything else. We've studied how much tier one capital the financial institutions should be holding, but we haven't actually studied, are they doing anything good and useful? You know, and so these are great questions to be asking.
Now, I'm intrigued because you did a lot of research on this. If I'm reading this right, you spent 3 years digging in this, and you've done a fabulous job from the sounds of it all. So what surprised you most in here?
Wow, that's a great question. I guess what was really fascinating to see is that things happen over time. Changes that have all of these perverse, unintended consequences happen over time. It wasn't there wasn't one silver bullet shift. I mean, there were some big shifts. I think the deregulation of the derivatives market was big. I think that the way in which monetary policy was unleashed and we started to rely on really low interest rates to create any growth at all was big. But it's this process, this sort of slow process where as finance got bigger and bigger and everyone was pulled into its orbit, almost like planets orbiting the sun, we just began to think of the markets differently and we all are oriented towards the markets. And the point of my book really is to start a conversation about how, guess what? This is totally the wrong way to look at things. The markets need to be oriented towards us. The markets need to be focused on helping Main Street. And actually, I'm becoming a little more hopeful because I think that the tech revolution in terms of crowd platforms, crowdfunding, and the sharing economy, the kind of Uberization of everything, even though that comes with some issues about labor protections and things like that, it also comes with opportunities to start creating a more old-fashioned market system where you're actually more tightly connecting people and capital at the ground level. And I think that that could maybe start us in the right direction back to a more functional system.
I totally agree with that analysis. And as well, they're a much more efficient use of capital, and we're going to have to be more efficient as growth slows. That's just part of the game. So I guess as a last question comment, I note that very important point you just made up that it's time to begin shifting that pendulum swing back to having our money system work for us instead of the other way around.
Right.
And I'm wondering how to get past that because I look at Japan, the largest retirement colony on the planet so far. And they are doing everything they can to stoke growth in an economy where they're actually losing people on a population basis. And the demographic shift is towards more elderly people. I would say if the economy was in service to the people, it could shrink. That would not be a bad thing, but they're desperately afraid of letting anything shrink. And I think that, again, points to an inversion of who's in service to whom. In this story, is there something more fundamental we need to look at here?
It's a great question. I mean, I think that the key thing is shift the narrative. And this is something I would like to see the next president do. And I'm a little worried because none of the candidates have fully articulated this idea that the markets are not a measure of our economic health. The markets need to be focused on Main Street health. I am encouraged that Janet Yellen, although she's in an incredibly tough position because we've come so far down the financialization road, I think she's a labor economist that is very concerned about Main Street job creation. And I know that the Fed is starting to have conversations internally about this topic and to throw a lot of things at the wall in terms of what might help goose productivity and job growth at a real fundamental level, you know, not just relying on low interest rates, not just relying on easy money, but thinking at a deeper level about what could create growth. So these are the conversations we need to be having. And hopefully whoever the next president is will push this ball forward.
Well, I certainly hope so. And from your lips to their ears, we've been talking with Rana Faruhar. She's got this new book out. It's fantastic. Makers and Takers. You can find it on Amazon. You can also find it at ranafaruhar.com. And we will have the link at the bottom of this podcast. Rana, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.